Herb. It's been a while since I saw Herb last, but he was just about the first person I met after my PhD, because my first position was at Caltech. Yeah, that's all right. First, let's vote. Right. This way, the transparencies are very clear, but it's dark in the audience, so I can't see if you're sleeping. You also, it might be hard to take notes, so we could turn some lights on, if so, right. Everything okay? Okay. This is a famous woodcut by Hokusai on a, well, maybe not so physical looking a breaking wave with Mount Fuji in the distance. That's not a wave, that's not Fuji. And this is not a traveling wave. It's maybe not so realistic a wave, but it's still very beautiful. I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk today about work with Dave Nichols, which was started as part of his PhD thesis at Brown University. He was a student in applied math. At that time, I was in the pure math department. He's then spent a postdoctoral years at Minnesota, and he's now assistant professor at Notre Dame. And thanks to the generous support of the NSF, the NSERC, and the Canada Research Chairs Program. So, I want to first, what I'm going to tell you about is a bifurcation problem with computational and with theoretical aspects having to do with Euler's equation for free surface water waves. Whoops, that's very badly out of focus. Whoops. Oh, yeah, that's this lens. Where's that lens? That's quite a bit better. So I'm going to go to those. I'm going to show you computations. I'm going to tell you about the theory, but I figure I should first tell you about the equations. So here they are. So the first slide is, and there's no pointer. I'll just point with my pen like this because that's easier. Okay. This. I'm going to zap somebody's eyes. I'm going to point with my pencil. Euler's equations for a free surface. So I'm looking for a fluid domain and the velocity field of a fluid. That's Euler coordinates for that's Eulerian coordinates for a fluid. I'm going to put a bottom. I'm going to be a member of the Flat Earth Society for this meeting. So my bottom is infinite extent and flat. So it's not very good for the Atlantic or the Pacific Ocean. It's maybe okay for Lake Ontario. And then I'm looking for a free surface above it, which I've drawn in blue, conveniently for blue water. Hopefully it's not too polluted. And I'm going to assume, although it's not true, you can tell from the woodcut, that the surface is a graph. It's not always going to be true. It will be true for my solution. And that graph I'm going to call y is equal to eta of x and t. Now, x is an n minus 1 dimensional variable. That is, there are n dimensional problems. One is vertical height. The other one is x1, x2, if you want to be mathematical, x3 up to xn minus 1. And but x is a vector, and obviously the most important and most interesting cases are n equals 2, that is a one-dimensional surface, or n equals 3, that is a two-dimensional surface. Now, I'm going to make an ideal fluid. So incompressible, that's very reasonable. And the vector field u is also irrotational, a little bit less reasonable. Not good behind a ship propeller. Also not good globally because of Coriolis force in the Atlantic. But maybe also not so bad for Lake Ontario. And then I've told you what happens in the fluid. I have to tell you what happens on the boundaries. So there's obviously a bottom boundary and a top. The bottom boundary, I want the fluid not to flow into the boundary. So I want the fluid at the bottom to flow tangentially. That is the normal derivative. That is u. Oops, I jumped. This is the compatibility conditions to give the flow as a potential, as a gradient of a potential, and this says that potential is harmonic. And that's my equation one. Sorry for jumping. And then everything else with a little red star is also going to be equation one. So that goes to the bottom I was just talking about that I jumped to. Flow on the bottom is tangential. That is u dot the normal is 0. That is, grad phi dot n is 0, so it's Neumann conditions on the bottom boundary condition, on the bottom boundary. On the top, it's not nonlinear, and it doesn't depend on time yet. So on top, those are encoded in the following boundary conditions, what's called the kinematic condition and what's called the Bernoulli condition. And I just want to point out a couple of things. G is the acceleration of gravity, so there's a restoring force due to gravity. Sigma is related to the Bond number. Sigma over GH squared is a dimensionless Bond number quantifying how much surface tension there is. And so I want to have a possible surface tension there, sigma times the mean curvature of the surface. That's reasonable. If it's very curved in one direction, there's a restoring force. Very curved in the other direction, there's a restoring force. And if you squint at this, you can see this as a force balance involving the pressure on the free surface and the mean curvature, that is, those restoring forces. And it kind of looks like Euler's equations themselves, if you've seen those. Anyway, those are the equations I want to solve. I'm going to solve them for sigma equals 0, and that is 0 Bond number, no surface tension, and also sigma positive. So let's see. I haven't given boundary conditions on the side, so I'd like to do that. And those will be as follows. There are a couple of cases to consider, and actually recently I've been talking about the solitary wave, where it says that the solution goes to 0 on the side, but I'm going to not do that today. I'm going to talk about a periodic case. I'm going to look at it spatially periodic waves. Look out at the ocean, and they're not very periodic. I apologize for that. Also, mathematically, I'm going to choose a period. I apologize for those oceanographers. But it's mathematically, it's the thing, it's the well-posed thing to do. So how to make something periodic with an n minus 1 dimensional surface? You choose an n minus 1 dimensional lattice, and then you say the surface repeats itself under translations in that lattice. Now, the funny thing is, the potential is not a physical quantity, except if you're in quantum mechanics, and we're not in this talk. So it doesn't Galilean translate very well, and you have this extra factor, but everyone knows that extra factor is there, so just do it. So that's how the potential translates. And then a traveling wave solution, I'm going to immediately now not solve the initial value problem. I'm going to solve a traveling wave problem. So traveling wave solutions look in the following form. A function, the surface eta, which a priori is a function of x, which changes in time, I want it to be such that if I fly over it with a helicopter with phase velocity, c is a velocity vector, n minus one dimensional vector, I fly over it in a helicopter with phase velocity c, that it is steady. Okay? And there's also a thing to do with phi. It looks like that. I didn't put a tc here because it's only the x derivative of phi, which enters into the physical equations. And then my nomenclature, just to make sure we're right, x is in R1, it's a two-dimensional problem. X in R2, it's a three-dimensional problem, etc. And so on the theoretical side, I'm going to paraphrase the theorem very simply. And it says, in dimension n equals 2, that is a one-dimensional surface, take any value to the surface tension, including 0, and any lattice. Well, lattice is in one dimension, or just you choose a period, and then you repeat it. So any value of surface tension in any lattice, there exist solutions to equation 1. And then the theorem in 3 and higher dimensions, that is 2 and higher dimensional surface, take any value of the surface tension, but 0 is not allowed. That's the only difference. And for any fundamental domain, that is any choice of lattice you have, there exist solutions of equation 1. And so your first objection might be, yeah, 0. So it's true. It is a solution. So actually, when I elucidate the theorem, I'm going to say that non-zero solutions. And then you're going to say, yes, well, if I make a two-dimensional solution, I just continue it steady and constant in the third direction. And that's also a solution in any higher dimension. And I say, yes. And part of them will be that, but also we'll have a structure of, it's a bifurcation problem, so we'll have a structure of solutions, including really genuine three-dimensional solutions, as well as two-dimensional solutions. And then you might ask, So I said this. This is a bifurcation problem for traveling waves. I want to tell you about the structure of that. And then why not zero surface tension in three and higher dimensions? And the answer is, I've translated out time, but nonetheless, so it turns out to be a nonlinear elliptic PDE, or an elliptic PDE with nonlinear oblique boundary conditions. But nonetheless, it has small divisors. There's no time, but it's a small divisor problem. And this is actually the heart of my interest in it, but I confess I haven't solved the difficulty yet. And it also brings to mind that I've talked about this and the fact that it's a small divisor problem before in front of some of you, and so I apologize that you have to listen to the same talk or a piece of the same talk as well. So it seems reasonable to show you some pictures of such solutions. So I thought I'd go through this for a few moments. This is a wave tank in it's actually in the lab in Penn State. And this silver bar is in front, and there's a glass, plexiglass wall here. And the silver bar is so I don't fall in from this side. And that silver bar in the back is so the other people don't fall in on the other side. I guess I could lower this and make it a little bit clearer. And then there's, you go in there, and there's a surface of water. And this is where it hits the side of the tank. And then this is the bottom, and then that's the back to there. And this is an I-beam set in the middle of the tank. And this bar has paddles hanging from it. And this is not an experiment. This was actually just fooling around. We had a small focused research group meeting at Penn State in 2000, in summer 2000. Oh, it didn't say it here. This is summer 2000. And they had, the glue had just dried on their new 3D wave tank, and they had just filled it up the day before. This is Diane Henderson and Joe Hammack. And they said, well, and they had 8 of their 32 precision computer-driven paddles running. And they said, well, let's try it out. So they put in an I-beam to separate the 8 from the other 24, and they ran the paddles pushing like this. And you look down the tank, and here are structure of the waves that are generated. And they looked very much like traveling waves, and also they looked very much like hexagons. You can see that picture on the surface, and you can see these acrostic patterns in the bottom. And I think that's beautiful. So that's one picture. Last summer, they were up and running experiments, and this really is an experiment, where they turned the light off and had some back, all the lab lights off and had some backlighting. Here you see somebody with a beer, maybe it's a Coke. And anyway, those are those 32 paddles. It's a little screwy because the end two paddles seem to be out of work, so it's not working well. So it's a little bit screwy in the edges. But here's a beautiful, what you might say, hexagonal or somewhat hexagonal pattern traveling down the wave tank. The light is behind us, and these are coming toward us. And that's also beautiful. So that's a real experiment. Third picture. These are from some of Dave Nichols' calculations that I mentioned. I'll put them sideways, so we'll have the same form as those waves coming down the wave tank toward us. This is a contour plot. They're going this way. That picture that I just showed you of the wave tank was deep water. It was 20 centimeters of water. The X2 wavelength was about 25 centimeters. If you had read the bottom, I didn't have it noted on the bottom, but it's about 25 centimeters. And the wavelength this way is about 10, 12, 13. So that's deep. That's effectively deep water. This is effectively shallow. This, for some reason, we chose 1 to 11 to get a nice long aspect ratio. And the depth is 1/100th. And these are incredibly flat, so very highly nonlinear waves, very incredibly flat, sharp crests, and this interesting zigzag pattern between these sort of hexagonal tiles of troughs. So very quite nonlinear. And this is a spectral method, which I'll talk about to some extent. No viscosity. There is actually no surface tension. So this is a small divisor problem. Seems to converge, doesn't it? Yeah, there's no surface tension. viscosity would be a drag. Sorry about the pun. Viscosity would, and you know what else really stops things is surface surfactant. So when these experimentalists do I should think, you know, just a little dust on the surface doesn't have any mass. Why is it bothering things? But you can really see it. And this careful experimentalist put talcum powder on the surface of their tank and skim it and then run their experiment. And you can see the difference. Substantially see the difference. It surprised me. Still hard for me to believe. Now, this is an older picture. It's a famous picture from JFM 1982 of an experiment in Tennessee. This is outdoors. Pretty rough. I mean, there are marsh grass, all sorts of things in this wave tank. But it's a big wave tank. And they're making big Stokes wave train way over here. And it's high enough to become unstable. And it becomes unstable to these beautiful crescent patterns. And this is effectively a periodic pattern. And one of the computational goals is to create this pattern. And, well, we haven't achieved it yet. And one of the goals of the theory is to make a setting where this pattern can exist. And that, I think, we have done, at least to some extent. And then, just to waste a little bit of time, you make the amplitude in the wave tank go up, and you get something which is harder to explain. And then, not everything in life is periodic. Here's a cool picture. This is what you do if you surf on tidal bores. You go all over the world, find cool places where there are tidal bores. It's just not a periodic wave, but it's still very beautiful. And this is what you do when you surf in Alaska on a tidal bore. I forget the name of the river. This guy has a wetsuit, I'm sure. Okay, as I said, this is a bifurcation problem. Brief history, and excuse me for slighting lots of people, but I wanted to give I'm just going to give a brief history of the existence theory. Actually, I'm going to say something. I jumped ahead again. I want to say my most important point now, which is when it's a one-dimensional surface, when it's a two-dimensional fluid motion, solutions arise in bifurcation curves. When it's a two-dimensional surface, three-dimensional fluid motion, there are two parameters, the two components of the phase velocity, and solutions arise in bifurcation surfaces. And I want to describe those surfaces to you. And I want to describe the structure of those surfaces near a bifurcation point, which is already interesting. So part of the remainder of the talk is going to be talking about that in the context of water waves. But let me, of course, give some credit where credit is due. The two-dimensional problem dates back to Levi Civita. 1925 paper in Mathenauen, no surface tension, infinite depth. And Dirk Struck, who was a postdoc there at his time, he died at the age of 103 a few years ago, did the finite depth case. And that introduced complex variable techniques, which permeated the problem for many years and still permeate the problem. And that's beautiful, but it's also not so good for three and higher dimensions. So one of the problems is to break that mold and get away from that setup. Adding surface tension, Eric Zeidler actually wrote a book on this with big bond number. That's to avoid resonances or multiple bifurcation. I'm sorry, I forgot to say this is a two-dimensional problem only. Tom Beal got small surface tension allowable, so that less than this critical one-third, that occurs for some reason, but he insisted explicitly that it not be resonant, that it's simple bifurcation, there's no extra kernel. Now, it turns out in two dimensions, if there is extra null space, if there is extra multiplicity, you're only allowed one extra. You can decide that looking at the dispersion relation. And Jones and Tolland wrote a paper in 1985 handling the resonant case, and those are called Wilton ripples. At least certain resonances of their class are called Wilton ripples. Three dimensions, we didn't find very much. There's a Reeder and Shinbrot paper, small amplitude, positive surface tension, again, the fundamental domains are they're two-dimensional surfaces, modulo lattice. I'm going to call that T of gamma. That's my fundamental domain. Non-resonant and symmetric diamond. Symmetric diamond means it's the following thing. Here's the axis, that's x1. Here's x2. The fundamental domain, that is the period of the wave, is going to look like this. I'm trying to make this symmetric around that. So it's as though this is an incoming wave, this is a wall, and this is the outgoing, and it's a steady situation in which that occurs. Okay? Sun had a similar thing with some bells and whistles, also positive surface tension. Right as we were, as Dave Nichols was finishing his thesis, and just a year after, Groves and Mielke sent us a preprint where they did rectangles, where the point was to make them rectangular and long and thin, also positive surface tension. And what we did was actually all cases. And it's an open problem, and I want to emphasize this. This is a small divisor problem, the existence theory for sigma equals zero. And I think it's a neat small divisor problem, too. So let's get down to some theory. So I want to rewrite the equations of motion. And often it's kind of a luxury to make it, to say, well, it's a Hamiltonian system. But here, actually, it turns out to be part of the analysis. So, yes? Local existence in a variety of settings, with and without surface tension. There's very few global existence theorems known. And in fact, those are limited to, well, zero exists globally, and these exist globally. That's about it. It'd be nice to have small data for a long time, but no small data for infinite. And it'd be nice that, you know, there are these equations where everything breaks except zero or except constants, like conservation laws. And then there are some where small data exist, large data don't. We're not in that setting. But we are in the setting where some exist, so we can't just say everything breaks. So it's a certain tension. Maybe a neighborhood of the traveling wave survives for all time. You know, I was at one point saying only Cantor sets of solutions in function space survive for all time. I'm not sure I'm ready to say that at this point, but, you know, it's in a dynamical system, studying something for all time is not a continuous object, and the phase space can divide up into funny sets depending on their long time behavior. It probably would not. It probably would not. Faraday problem is another another character and a bit different. So it's pretty different than Faraday problem is where you take a pan of water and you shake it up and down. And that's closer to a standing wave problem, I would say, and that's a small divisor problem. And so it's a whole other story. So it turns out to be relevant, kind of pleasing to tell you the truth, but it turns out to be relevant that it's a Hamiltonian system. So I want to tell you about a way, a nice way. There's a zillion ways, but as a nice way to make it Hamiltonian. And this maybe is the original way or related to the original way. So the fluid domain is y between minus h and eta and x in a fundamental domain. Remember, I'm not making surf. Now, the energy, I think all of us could write that down, which is a kinetic energy part. Grad phi is the velocity, so velocity squared upon 2. Mass, here it should be density, is 1. We've normalized that. Add it all up with this integral, that's the kinetic energy. Plus the potential energy. It turns out the potential energy due to the gravity is L2 norm times g upon 2 of the surface. Potential energy due to surface tension is sigma times the area minus a reference area. Incidentally, while we're doing these exercises, the momentum is the velocity in the the momentum is a vector, ij, j equals 1 through n minus 1, so 1 and 2 for us, is the uj, which is d by the xj of phi, integrated over the domain, and if you just integrate by parts, you get this expression. What's hard and what's subtle is the choice of canonical conjugate variables. And so this was written down in a 1968 paper of Sakharov, which was debated for 20 years, probably still being debated. And every few months in JFN, there's another paper by somebody else's interpretation of this. Well, so I get to advertise this is my interpretation. which is canonical conjugate variables. This is clearly in Sakharov. Z, let's say, this is a vector of functions, is eta c, where c are the boundary values of the velocity potential. And then the velocity potential is parameterized by, one, the boundary, two, its boundary values on that boundary. And then Euler's equations can be rewritten, all those things I had on a couple slides ago, as the following. Sorry about the glitch in writing. D by dt of eta, so eta dot is equal to the variation of h with respect to the boundary data, and d by dt of c is minus the variation of h with respect to the domain. And that's in Hamiltonian form, z dot is equal to j grad h. And I just point out to you, how does this depend on eta and c? A bit implicitly. That's one of the big things over that debate of Sakharov's Hamiltonian. Well, I said I was allowed to give you my own little version. So here's one slide of that. A convenient way, not a unique way, but a convenient way to parameterize that Hamiltonian is to introduce the Dirichlet-Neumann operator for the domain. So that is, C is the boundary values. And then you do the following thing. You're given a domain. You take C, you Laplace solve with those data and the bottom boundary data and the periodicity. You take its gradient of the solution dot the normal d surface element, and you define that to be g eta xc. Sorry, should have been dx. I forgot the dx. To make it normalized correctly, so it's a self-adjoint operator. And then using this, you write down the Hamiltonian, as Kathleen Sulem and I did in a paper a while ago, which is the Dirichlet integral is rewritten as half c g eta xc. Well, that's you can get from this by integration by parts, and using the fact that phi is harmonic satisfies the bottom boundary condition. The other two terms in potential energy are the same. And then you rewrite Euler's equations again, which is eta xc dot is equal to j variation of h. And let me point out what this entails. The xc variation of h is pretty easy because xc enters in a quadratic form with this self-adjoint operator. It's pretty realistic to realize that because you're solving Laplace's equation, which is a linear equation, once you have the domain and the boundary data. Now, eta, and I have to take the eta variation of h, a little bit more interesting. Well, this is pretty easy to vary, and this variation gives you that mean curvature. But this is you take the Dirichlet integral, and you vary that with respect to the domain, which is an interesting calculation dating to what I would say the variational formula of Adamard in about the 1940s. It's related to that. And then whether this is useful or not depends on whether you can understand G. So here's a remark about G. It takes H1 to L2. It's analytic as a function of eta as long as eta remains Lipschitz. And analytic means it has a Taylor expansion. And the Taylor expansion, moreover, is computable. And moreover, it's recursively computable. So you can make your machine compute it. In fact, you say, I want m terms, and there's a recursion formula that generates the mth term from the m minus 1 term, second term from the first, third term from the first and second, et cetera. And just to give you an idea of what these look like, let me write d as 1 upon I d by dx, and then g naught is d tanh hd. You can already guess that from, it's already in Lamb, to tell you the truth, if you interpret it right. But g1 is a little different. It starts having etas. It should be homogeneous degree 1 in eta. Here's 1 power of eta. And it looks like that. And they don't, g's and etas don't commute, and et cetera. And they're computable. I guess that's my point. So I have lost traveling waves for a little bit. So let me come back to traveling waves. Well, traveling waves have this form, that eta better be a function of x minus tc, and c should be x minus tc. You normalize that other factor away. And then, therefore, they should satisfy the time derivative is equal to minus c dot the x derivative of that vector. And I want to point out that that is actually c dot j grad the momentum. I had them in a previous momenta I had on a slide ago. I'm sorry. Not up right now. Momenta are 2, c is a 2 vector, that's what it looks like. And so you substitute in the equations and you get that. And then you write it out using that you can do the variation of the Dirichlet integral with respect to the domain, and you get some long expression. But I want to say that this expression is conceptually quite simple. So that goes as follows. So you rewrite it. What I had here in the delta H minus C delta I, that's this, and keeping track of the J and getting rid of the J in the right place. And then you can make a formal variational principle, very formal variation problem out of it. I don't guarantee this is a good variational problem for the direct methods of calculus of variation, but it's at least a formal method, which is a guiding principle. And that goes as follows. Let S be an immersion of a n minus 1 torus. That's your possible surface. And consider some Sobolev space of such. I need both eta and xi to behave periodically, so those are part of the immersions. It's the immersion into the phase space. And I want to in all possible such immersions, I want to constrain those to a submanifold. So those possible immersions, which have the first momentum is equal to one fixed number a, the second momentum is one fixed number a2. If it's an n minus one, if it's an n-dimensional problem, I'm going to have n minus one momenta for the n minus one horizontal variables. Constrain them to be a1 through an, and that gives me a manifold of codimension n minus one. Let's talk about the three-dimensional problem. So n minus one is two. This is a codimension two function space, the rest of the dimensions. And then equation 5 is the Lagrange multiplier rule on M for critical points of H. And the Lagrange multiplier itself gives you the phase velocity. And then, remembering Morse theory, the topology of M, I forgot to write it, influences the number of critical points. The more topology you have, in general, it makes possible to have more critical points of H. And even more so, every time you find a critical point, you find actually a critical torus, because the functionals H and I are invariant under where you put the origin. So that gives you a natural torus motion, torus action on the problem. And therefore, MA is invariant, and H is invariant, and I is invariant. And so every time you find a critical point, you find an entire orbit of a torus. And the quotient space has even possibly more topologies, even more critical points. I'll come back to this point. So what I want to do is study the linear problem. So now I'm going to do bifurcation, the bifurcation analysis. And so what I want to do is study the linear. So the thing to do is study the linear problem. So zero is a solution. And I linearize that equation, just takes another derivative, another. And then I want to find solutions of this equals f, if I were to invert the linear problem. And a bifurcation point would be where I can't invert the linear problem. So rather, I find a null space of this equation 6. So I want to describe the homogeneous solutions. So that's on this slide, if I actually get it centered and in focus. There's a different focus on top and bottom of this screen. So in a because it is around zero, it's a constant coefficient problem, naturally diagonalizes in a Fourier basis, so introduce all the Fourier modes, which you label by wave number k in the dual lattice to the period fundamental, the lattice defining the fundamental period. That's the standard thing for multiply periodic functions. And then you can compute things, for example, the Dirichlet-Neumann operator on a Fourier mode. It turns out to be k tangent hk times that Fourier mode. So that's diagonal. And so there's a theorem about the linearized equation. And so that's my second theorem, which is for sigma. It's a pretty easy theorem. I'm going to prove it with these green circles. For sigma greater than 0, the linear equation, 6 over there, 6 on the bottom over there, has at most a finite dimensional null space. I'm going to call that x1 in x. It's the set of immersions, and it's finite dimensional subspace of those immersions. And it's always even dimensional. I'm going to call that dimension 2m. And And what do I want to say? If sigma is equal to 0, it could be infinite. That's one of the problems. So let's see what that, oh, and I also wanted to say it's y even, well, you might say, from the structure of the problem, from the reason that it's a Hamiltonian system, something like that. So in the Fourier basis, the linearized operator, that thing, 6, looks like this, diagonal 2 by 2 pieces in all the Fourier modes. And so you have to find a null, a 0 of this. So that's like a dispersion relation, saying find C and K satisfying this. And so let's do the following thing. I'm going to fix K1. I want this Fourier mode to be contribute, and then I adjust C. Oh, and then the 0 set of this is this green line. So I fix K1, and I adjust C until I get this 0 set to touch. But C is two-dimensional parameter, so you can imagine adjusting C again where I keep this touching, and I touch my other favorite mode. So I can actually choose two modes and get that green null 0 set, and then that gives me 2 points, so two complex exponentials in my null space, and since it's even, I get the minuses, so that's m equals 2, so that's 4. That corresponds to simple bifurcation. The minimum interesting is 4 dimensions. M equals 2. But of course, in doing that, you might have hit another one, and that corresponds to higher multiplicity. So it could be m could be higher. M is finite because these are compact circles. These are not compact if it's if surface tension is non-zero. That's the linear theory. Results. So results. Whoops. Solutions of that correspond to resonances, you might say. And I'm going to fix n equals 3 because n equals yes. Yeah, that goes back to this mathematical question. What is the period? I fix my lattice.
Yeah,
I can rotate the lattice, but that's a different lattice in my notation. Right. Right. It very well could. For geometric reasons, you can have higher multiplicity. And I'll give an example in a couple of slides. Even a square may only have 2, because that rotation might just give you back the same thing. You choose 2, and you rotate by pi over 2, and you might get 1 goes to 2, 2 goes to 1. So being square doesn't guarantee, I don't think, that m is higher. But it could. There are certain settings in which it might be higher. And I'll show you one important one, at least one that fluid dynamics think is important. It's a very good point, and we'll head back in that direction after I do the simple bifurcation case. So I'm going to fix n equals 3, because n equals 2 is sort of done, and n equals 4 is not so physical. And let's do the two cases. Case 1, m equals 2, simple bifurcation. In case 2, m greater than or equal to 3, higher multiplicity. So I want to tell you about the simple bifurcation. So it goes like this. For dimension 3 and positive surface tension, the solution set consists locally near the bifurcation point, that C which I've told you you can adjust to find, of 4 intersecting bifurcation surfaces, all of them analytic. So I wanted to explain why 4. Well, let's start out with simple bifurcation curves when we're in the two-dimensional setting, or when we're in the more conventional one-dimensional kernel. Well, you have a space of trivial solutions, and then you find a bifurcation point, C0, and you find a non-trivial branch of solutions. So S1 is the trivial, S2 is the other, and these have tangent spaces which are. So at this point, it's not a manifold. It's an intersection of two varieties, and each variety has its tangent space. So you take those two tangent spaces, and they are transversal, and they intersect in a point. So I now want to use that analogy to work on the bifurcation surface for the simple bifurcation in this case? Well, C is two dimensions. The null space is 2 times 2 dimensions, but there's a 2 torus symmetry, so I'm going to go down to 4 without saying much more about that reduction. So I think of, I'm now sitting in four-dimensional space, 2 parameters, effectively 2 eigenfunctions. In that four-dimensional space, there is the trivial solutions, which is set your solution to 0, and C varies over the plane. That's the trivial solution, like this. Although I dasn't to draw it, I'll get in trouble if I try to draw four dimensions. Now, what are the rest? What are the other three varieties? And the claim, the part of this theorem is that these are analytic varieties of analytic solutions near the origin. So, one of the varieties, I'd like to so that the second variety has that tangent space which intersects the tangent space of the first one, that is a trivial solution, in a line. Sorry, I looked as though I was writing French there for a moment. And then a third variety intersects, is a similar one intersecting the trivial solutions in another line, but it intersects that second variety in a point. And so the tangent spaces intersect in a point. Well, two planes, and these are two-dimensional surfaces, 2D surfaces. C is two-dimensional, and the others are two-dimensional as well. So in two planes and four dimensions intersect in a point, exactly it. So this is the expected case. And then there's finally the most interesting variety with S4, and its tangent space intersects tangent space of 3 in a line. So S4 intersects S3 locally in a curve. S4 intersects S2 locally in a curve. And S4 intersects S1 in a point. And that's the structure of simple bifurcation in these settings. Let's see if I can give you a picture of this. Well, let me do the following little zip through a bunch of slides. I'm going to do the n equals 2 first and then n equals 3. So these are pictures of bifurcation curves in the two-dimensional case. And you can see this is not 0. This starts from C naught, and this goes up, that gains elevation. And you can see this famous Tanaka instability. It turns around, and this is the Sharpe-Stokes crest. And the solution there looks like that. That's the one on top. And the others look smoother. But this is exaggerated vertically, so the solution really looks like that. So that's like a two-dimensional picture. And then there's a pattern of subharmonic bifurcations associated with that, which I won't give you. This is not unique calculations of Dave Nichols. This is repeats of many calculations of fluid dynamicists, often at Caltech. So there's some famous calculations in the 80s of Chen and Safman, and this reproduces, and Zufiria, Safman and Zufiria. And this reproduces some of that detail. So what I want to do is give you this as the numerics of this. Well, here's the bifurcation surface. Well, I can't draw four dimensions, and neither can the computer in a still picture. Well, I guess it could with colors, but I'm sorry, I'm just too primitive at this point. But if I put the norm in U, so that is the two Z components, and this is S3, S4. This is the interesting one. This surface intersects the parameter plane in a point, and it's a two-dimensional surface, and this is the line of symmetry. And this is the line where it intersects, the curve where it intersects S3, or maybe it's S2. And actually, I don't know which line is which, so I'm just faking it. But I just wanted to draw you this, and now I thought I could write my slides and talk on the phone at the same time, but apparently I can't. So this is Dave Nichols, and I wrote his name upside down. So I'm sorry. Here's the center, here's the curve where I'm intersecting S4 and S3. I'm drawing a line along S4. And I'm starting at the curve where S4 is equal to S3. Well, this is supposed to look like a Stokes wave, flatter troughs, sharper crests, moving in one direction. And then I'm going to move along S4 away from there. So I'm moving actually in a circle on a disk in the bifurcation surface. And this is a bit of a step. I really didn't get the title in here, so I can't tell you how far of a step. But I'm moving in sections along that curve. Here I'm more, and here it's a perfect symmetric momentum in the x1 direction solution, which flat troughs and sharper crests, a true three-dimensional wave. I want you to keep this in mind, and especially that, because I'm going to give you a variety of pictures of that. And I also would like to, say that these numerics are based on spectral methods, which are based on that Hamiltonian formulation that I gave you a bit ago in my introduction to the talk. Okay, let's do this more. Those are really just drawing out a piece on a bifurcation surface. I'm going to stay on the center line. And what I want to do is change another parameter for you. I'm going to change H. And so I'm going to give you a brief survey of numerics for these traveling waves where H is going to go from shallow. This is 1/100th, so aspect ratio 11 to 1 to 1/100th, with a few printer glitches, I'm sorry there. And these are those I gave you I already showed you a picture of the very flat troughed, very sharp crested waves. Actually, it took me a while to parse this. This is a flat trough, and these are the cross sections of those very sharp crests. So this is a pretty nonlinear wave. Often fluid dynamics, you measure things by steepness. This is a pretty steep wave. Here's what I should have showed you before, and I should have showed you the thing before now, because this is not quite as far up the bifurcation branch as that, but same 1 to 11 to 1/100th. A very nice flat troughs, and basically hexagonal-shaped or six-sided wave shapes. Make H deeper. This is now H is 1, so it's 1, 1, 11. And these things look like rolls. They've changed their geometry really quite dramatically. Again, you can detect their nonlinearity because they are very long and flat with pretty sharp transition zones between those offset regions. But in the direction of motion, they are really quite big, what you might call dramatic rollers, rather than these flat crests, flat troughs, sharp crested things. And here's a contour plot of that. And this is H is equal to 1. Whoops, make them come at you. It's hard to tell the troughs from the crest, but the slightly sharper crest, slightly flatter trough. And just to show you that nothing much happens as you get H bigger, this is H equals infinity. It looks about the same. And contour plot H equals infinity looks about the same. So I find that interesting. And we have not done, but I would like to do, explore that transition between H is equal to one 1/100th and H is equal to about 1/10th, where it starts looking like deep water. And I think that should be stepped out carefully, but that's a project to be. In case people have finishing students who want postdoctoral program and are comfortable with a computer as well as with a bit of theory, and then they should please write me or give me a call. So I have to finish by talking about the higher multiplicity bifurcation problem. So this is with m greater than or equal to 3. And so this is, again, an elucidation, really, of Theorem 1, where I said there exist solutions. And then you could say, yes, but I always knew 0 was a solution. So this says, for the traveling wave problem in three dimensions, positive surface tension, and multiplicity of null space 2m, where m is greater than or equal to 3. So 2 is the simple. This is 3 and higher, multiple bifurcation. Then the theorem says, on every non-singular surface of fixed momentum, that is, x1 momentum is a1, x2 momentum is a2, there are at least m minus 1 many critical points, that is, distinct critical points of the Hamiltonian H, so geometrically distinct solutions of the traveling wave problem. as I said, each time you have a solution, you also can translate it, so that gives you a whole torus of solutions of the Hamiltonian. And let me tell you about, and this is for Martin Golubitsky, one situation in which you're forced to have higher multiplicity. Well, these actually are resonances. And so it's the same to solve these two resonant equations as to solve that zeros of the dispersion relation for a number of wave numbers, as I said. So what I need to do is find wave numbers in a given lattice which satisfy three resonance conditions. It looks like two resonance conditions, but these are wave vectors. So this is two conditions, this is one. Well, I'm going to satisfy the first condition by simply saying the following. Why not take my principal wave number in the K1 direction, normalize it as such, and take three of them. So here's K1. I'm going to take three copies. And then I'm going to take K2 up a little bit, going 1.5, and then 1.5 over, and then K3 down the same angle, 1.5, so that they form to make that triangle. That means that 3K1 is equal to K2 plus K3. Automatically satisfies the momentum conservation part of the resonance condition. Now we have free the angle. So you can adjust the angle so that the frequencies as well are in resonance. And this is a 5-mode resonance, because you count 3 plus 1 plus 1, that's 5. And there's always such an angle H, and in fact, the angle starts out for deep water, starts out here at some canonical angle, which I've forgotten, but it's like the arctan of, let me see, arctan 3 root 5 over 4 is the canonical angle, I think. We can look it up. Sort of like the Kelvin angle for a shipwreck. This is a canonical angle for deep water for a periodic pattern. And then by adjusting this down to 0 as H goes to 0, and in the limit, you also get the analog of the KP periodic waves when H tends to 0. And I want to tell you, I want to finish up by telling you how to prove that. Oh, I want to finish up by two things. One, an analogy, and then how to prove that. The analogy probably is more important than how to prove it. So the analogy, and I apologize again to people like Bill Lanford, who's had to listen to this talk, or a good part of this talk a second time. It's an analogy with the resonant Lyapunov center theorem. So Lyapunov wrote a theorem on periodic orbits near a center that are non-resonant, published in the Toulouse Annals in 1907. And this was revisited by Alan Weinstein in a 74 paper, and I'm actually following Moser's approach, which is more general and had somewhat stronger results in 79. And let's just forget water waves and go to a Hamiltonian system in 2n dimensions. So phase spaces are 2n. A Hamiltonian system in this is this equation 7. And I want to suppose that the 0 is a stationary point. So grad H is 0 at 0. And moreover, H is positive definite there. Well, you need not have this for Moser's theorem, but I'm going to take it, and it's our setting anyway.